These various appropriations of genetics aim to further race realism and hereditarian explanations of racial and social behavioural differences. Beyond these substantive aims on a metapolitical level, they serve to reframe concepts and standards for political and scientific discussion of race challenges, structures of academic legitimacy and expertise, and build a cadre of ideological foot soldiers armed with an argumentative toolkit. As professional anthropologists and geneticists aim to accurately communicate their science and its implications for understanding human differences to the public, they must contend with these substantive claims and metapolitical contexts. Amen. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today, I would like to talk about a very interesting paper which has come to my attention called How White Nationalists Mobilise Genetics from Ancestry and Human Biodiversity and Counterscience and Metapolitics by Aaron Panofsky, Kushan Disgupta and Nicole Iturriaga of UCLA and of the Max Planck Institute. Now, what it raises is a very interesting question, which is about the professionalisation of science. What they basically argue is that as far as science should be a guild, that you should be taken seriously as a scientist if you have certain qualifications and if you have been initiated into the guild, that science is a matter of authority. If a person who attains guild membership of being, let's say, a psychologist, is a person who has a doctorate in psychology and a person who is affiliated to a psychology department at a university, that person should be taken seriously. That person has the right to pronounce on science. Anybody who deviates from that, either because they are not accepted by the Guild of Psychologists, or they are not affiliated to a psychology department, or they do not have a PhD in psychology, what they have to say is ipso facto less logical and less worth taking seriously in the realm of science, because they are not fully part of the guild. Now, this is a fundamentally different way of seeing science from the way in which it's traditionally been seen. Traditionally, science is understood as the search for truth. You present your science, you present logical argumentation, you present empirical data, and you present it perhaps to the scientific community in the form of books, which they can read, or in the form of academic papers published in journals, which they can read and which they can critique. And so something is accepted as being science, and you are an expert on science, as it were, because of what you have published, because you have successfully done science. Science is something that you do. It doesn't matter who does it. It doesn't matter what qualifications you have. You could have no qualifications at all, and you can do science. And that was the traditional understanding of science when science began to develop into a guild. So, for example, you had in the 19th century Thomas Edward, the Aberdeenshire shoemaker. He had no scientific qualifications whatsoever. He was a shoemaker who was interested in science, and he used to collect fossils and shells and things like that, and he used to categorise them, and he was widely recognised as the world expert on things like on these kinds of shells and things he used to collect. That was Thomas Edward. He was an amateur scientist. But all scientists were amateurs. All scientists of any note in history, really, until quite recently, almost all scientists you can think of that have made any major contribution have been amateurs. And it is the guild scientists who are the incrementalists, who do little tidy contributions but don't make major contributions to science. Now, what this paper is a defence of the guild mentality of science. And it is very unhappy that people that are not part of the guild are able to make contributions to science. And its essential argument is almost like you should be sceptical of them. They shouldn't be allowed to do so. So in the paper, he basically says that genetic ideas are appropriated by what he calls the alt-right. Now, what the alt-right are, as we know by definition, are a group of people who do not agree with the dominant viewpoint in contemporary anthropology. This, by the way, this paper was published in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology. And that viewpoint is that there is no such thing as race. Race is a social construct. It's only based around superficial differences. It doesn't really exist, and no serious person should take it seriously. Now is not the place to go into the counter arguments against that. But what they argue is that this kind of is that there are these amateur scientists that use data which is publicly available to support an hereditarian and race realist position. It then looks at the so-called strategies that they use in order to do this. And one of the strategies that they use is what's called the open psych journals. These are a series of journals founded by Emil Kierkegaard, which allows what they call amateurs, and they use this word, I think, pejoratively, because the word amateur does have a pejorative sense to it these days, to publish papers to, in their words, legitimate their projects. This, they argue, is a problem because it challenges proper academics, that's to say academics that work at universities and are professional academics, in terms of their legitimacy and their expertise. They argue that this produces a series of what is called citizen scientists who do not have academic credentials, and they go through the nature of these citizen scientists. They lack a PhD, so they only have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. They lack a PhD, that's problem one. Or if they have a PhD, it's not in the particular area that they're talking about. So it's not in psychology, it's in something else. Or they have a PhD and they have affiliations to a psychology department, but they are a bit weird, they are a bit fringe, they don't accept the dogmas of the church, and they are connected to the Mankind Quarterly and the Pioneer Fund. And so in all three of these ways, they are outsiders. They are either not qualified because they don't have a PhD, or they are qualified, they are members of the guild by having a PhD, but they are at a low rank of qualification because they are not professional, the PhD is not in the right subject, or they are not affiliated to a department, they're not professional scientists, or they are affiliated to a department but they're just sort of bad people, they're outsiders to the community, to the guild of science, they're considered on the fringe of the guild. And that is the way that they see, that's the way they understand science. So they understand science, that's why I made the reference to the Pastafarianism religion at the beginning, almost as a sort of religious guild, whereby you enter the guild almost as a monk, as a novitiate entering a monastery, and you are accorded the rank of guild membership. And that rank is that you have a PhD. If you don't have a PhD yet, you are not a member of the guild. So the PhD accords you the rank of membership of the Guild of Science. But it should only allow you to discuss areas of science that are specific and pertinent to that PhD. So if you move beyond that, then you're a dangerous radical and you're something of an amateur, and that's a problem. Now, once you've got that, that's at a low level, and you should be taken a bit seriously because you have a PhD, but you should be taken more seriously if you have a PhD in the particular subject. So in a sense, the fact that you have the PhD in the subject should trump the fact that you present logical arguments based on empirical data. So this is showing you that their conception of truth is not objective truth. Their conception of truth is based around authority. Truth emanates from authority, rather like in a religious sense. If Moses, if the prophet says something, then it's true. And if it contradicts what empirical reality tells you, then you should have the humility to realise that your perception of empirical reality may be wrong. The next step in the religion, once you have the PhD and you have the PhD in the right subject, is that you are a professional scientist, that your full-time job is to be a scientist, that society, in a sense, has accorded you the status of being a professional scientist. And this means you have authority even over those who have doctorates in the related subject but are not professional scientists, because you do it full-time. You are higher up in the guild. You are, as it were, rather like a bishop or something like that. You are higher up in the guild. And so your whole conception of truth is not the scientific conception of truth. That is to say, there is an objective truth out there which can be found through logic and through reason and through gathering data, and that anybody can do this. It is that truth is restricted to members of the guild. It's almost like a mystical guild whereby you achieve a further understanding, Gnostic guild, whereby you achieve a further understanding of truth by moving up the hierarchy of the guild. And this is completely, this is how they see it, and this is completely inimical to what science should be. Because as I've discussed a lot before on this channel, if we look at the nature of the genius, that is, a genius is a person who is widely recognised as making huge, groundbreaking contributions to science, then you would expect someone like that to be an amateur. And indeed, if you look at those who are widely accepted as having been geniuses, such as Charles Darwin, such as whatever, these people would be dismissed by this kind of group of people as amateurs who somehow shouldn't be taken seriously. Now, what is the nature of the genius? As we've discussed before, the genius combines outlier high IQ, very, very, very high IQ, with moderately antisocial personality traits. He is moderately low in what's called agreeableness, that is empathy and altruism, and moderately low in what's called conscientiousness, that is to say impulse control and rule following. Now, the fact that he's low in empathy and altruism, his new ideas always offend. They always offend against vested interests, always. But he doesn't care about that. And indeed, it's been shown that these scientific geniuses are a bit autistic, i.e. they are low in empathy. So not only does he not care about that, he couldn't conceive that it would offend people even if he did care, because he's a bit socially blind, he's a bit socially clumsy, he's a bit autistic. And this means, which by the way is associated with outlier high IQ, and this means that he takes in more information, takes in more detail, because autism is associated with being hypersensitive to stimuli and taking in more detail. It's associated with being obsessed with solving problems and finding the truth, which means is associated with genius, because genius is about solving problems. And also, it means that he doesn't care, or he's not unable to conceive of offending people with his radical new truth-challenging ideas. Then he is moderately low in conscientiousness. Conscientiousness is about impulse control, a desire to follow rules, a desire to play the game. But if you're a genius, you're low in impulse control, and that means you think in quite an intuitive way. You make bizarre connections. You can make all kinds of connections between all kinds of things, because you don't follow the rules. You don't think in this kind of straight-jacketed manner that the rule-following type of person thinks in. You're a non-conformist, basically. And so that's what... So, for example, Darwin's office was widely regarded as total chaos, like a bomb had hit it. So that's the kind of people that these are. Now, these people are the exact opposite of the kind of people that are going to involve themselves in a science guild. How do you get involved in a guild? To get involved in a guild and to move up the hierarchy of a guild, of an organisation, you have to be what my colleague Bruce Charlton has called the head girl type. What is the head girl type like? The head girl type has is highly intelligent, but not outlier high intelligence, because outlier high intelligence wouldn't help you to be a head girl. Because being a head girl, you have to get on with the teachers, and you have to be conformist, and you have to be a bit of a brown noser and whatever, to be the head girl of a school. You have to get on with all the teachers and the authorities. So you're not going to have outlier high IQ, because that might make you of a highly questioning disposition with regard to authorities. That's no good. Secondly, the head girl is going to be very, very hard working, very, very diligent, very, very socially conformist, very, very interested in getting on socially and getting on in the school organisation. This means she's going to be high in agreeableness, high in altruism, high in empathy, socially skilled, and focused on achieving socially approved roles. So secondly, she's going to be high in conscientiousness. She's going to follow the rules. She's going to impress the teachers. She's going to be a good girl. She's rather like the Prime Minister of Finland. You know, high in impulse control, high in emotional control, highly unoriginal in her thinking, but very, very good at learning things, very, very good at imbibing information, very, very good at solving problems that are similar to the problems that she's seen before. But she's going to be highly socially conformist, and this is exactly what will allow her to get on in the guild, and indeed any guild, because when she turns up at job interviews, then she's going to come across as the kind of person you'd want to work with. She's going to come across, and she's not going to rock the boat. She's going to be socially skilled, socially aware. She's going to come across as a nice person, a pleasant person. She's going to smell the air and realise what you have to think in order to get on, and she's going to adopt that way of thinking. If she's going to be a scientist, then she'll be the kind of scientist that will get on in the guild, do her PhD in psychology or whatever it is, get a job as a psychologist, make tiny, tiny little contribution to psychology, nothing too radical, nothing too boat rocking, nothing too peculiar, nothing too problematic, and she's going to move up the hierarchy. And she can't comprehend people like the genius type, who think in an intuitive way. She can't comprehend people like the genius type, who look at areas out, that make connections, because they have low impulse control, low conscientiousness, that make connections outside their subject. And that's another thing that's very interesting, that a lot of these people that are geniuses, they start off in a subject other than the subject in which they become well known. Now, why is this? Well, it's because if you are highly creative in your thinking, then you will make connections between lots of different things. If you're uncreative in your thinking, you won't do that. You'll just sort of follow a path where you'll make incremental little changes in the subject in which you are trained, and it won't occur to you to look at and think about the bigger picture, to engage in what E.O. Wilson has called consilience. That won't occur, and to look at areas outside your subject. And what you notice is that the people that are geniuses, people that do highly original things, geniuses or that have genius traits, J. Philip Rushton, for example, started off in psychology, and his big contribution was in biology. the person that came up with the Flynn effect, Jim Flynn, major contribution, he presumably wouldn't be accepted by these people either, because he started off in political science, but his major contribution was in psychology. And you can think of many, many, with the Flynn effect, but you can think of many, many, many other examples of this, that the major important scientists that matter, the geniuses or the semi-geniuses, the people that make big breakthroughs, they tend to start off in different subjects. And often, indeed, they tend to be amateurs. Now, why does genuine science militate in favour of being an amateur? Well, let's look at this. First of all, if you are involved in a university guild, in the university organisation, there's a degree to which you have to conform, or you can be thrown out of that organisation. So if you're reliant on the university for your livelihood, you have to be careful. As the university becomes increasingly politically dominated, whether it's dominated by religion, back in the 19th century, when it was dominated by religion and you couldn't say things about religion, or now where it's dominated by our new multicultural religion, as a professional scientist, in a university, you have to be careful what you say. And so this pushes out of the university the genuinely creative, sort of semi-genius, original types. So therefore, they're more likely to be amateurs because they can't get on in the guild system because of the nature of the guild system suppressing truth, but also because of the nature of their personality, that they're non-conformists, that they're low in empathy, that they don't understand these rules of the guild and they can't get on in it. And that's why in the 19th century, the major breakthroughs were all done by amateur scientists, people that were independently wealthy, like Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, by the way, would be the ultimate example of what they would regard as an amateur scientist. So Charles Darwin had a qualification in theology from Cambridge. He had no formal qualification whatsoever in actual science. He was not affiliated to a university other than having a master's degree from Cambridge. He had no university affiliation. And he was an independent scholar. He was exactly the kind of person that would have published in these open psych journals and would have been regarded as highly controversial at the time. And the people that were working at the universities would have dismissed him as not being part of the guild, as trying to, I don't know, promote irreligiousness into science or whatever it happens to be. But he was the ultimate example of a citizen scientist. Thomas Edward, who I mentioned earlier, again, ultimate example of a citizen scientist. No funding. He was just an amateur, a shoemaker who in his spare time would do science. And he made these highly original contributions. And indeed, most of these kinds of people, that was how they operated. Most of the great scientists that made the Industrial Revolution and these kinds of people that made great breakthroughs, they weren't working within the guild of the university, because the guild of the university selects in favour of these head girl types that are conformist. I've called in other videos the midwits, these head girl types that are conformists and who don't want to rock the boat. Whereas it is therefore those that are outside the university system that are more likely to A, be the kind of people, high IQ plus moderately antisocial traits, who will be able to make original breakthroughs, and will B, be able to pursue those original breakthroughs, because they won't be straitjacketed by the ideological strictures and the social strictures of working within the guild. And so what you see in this paper is two fundamentally different conceptions of truth made flesh. One is the conception of truth of the open sight type people, which is just that science is about coming to, they actually cite this, Robert Merton, science is about coming to the truth about reality, about creating empirically accurate models based on the available data. That is what science is there to do. Versus their view of science, which is kind of implicitly expressed, which is that science is this guild organization where your purpose is, as a scientist, you are a professional scientist. It is your job to be a scientist. Science is a job. And you do that job and you conform to the church, basically. And one of the things that then you see in the paper as well, and you see this a lot with professional science, is a sort of an attempt to make people think that you are in the presence of a profound mind. And this is another aspect to sort of priesthood, that if you're not based around logic and reason, and you know, your arguments don't really work, then you have to make people think that you are in the presence of someone deep and profound, sort of beat them into intellectual submission. And you see this in the way this article's written, with a completely unnecessary high order language. Let me quote a sentence from it. It says, Okay, borrowing from the film The Matrix, where the hero takes a red pill to understand the nature of reality, alt-right metapolitics aims to develop red pills that will reveal the fallacies of mainstream culture and politics, while building soft power outlets and practices to rival that which they see as the intellectual hegemony of the left in the media and universities. Appropriating genetics can develop these red pills that aim to instantiate racial hereditarianism into multicultural society, reorganise political and intellectual authority, and arm alt-right foot soldiers with discursive skills and tools to reshape debate and win converts, instantiate. Is the obvious hegemony, discursive skills. These are attempts to convey to the audience that they are in the presence of a profound mind, because there is no logic or reason whatsoever in the article itself. All the article is basically trying to say is that we are professional scientists, and professional scientists should be believed over these non-professional scientists, because professional scientists are ideologically sound. Professional scientists are more sort of intelligent and deep, as evidenced in their use of intelligent and deep language and forms of language. And professional scientists are basically just on the winning team and are more trustworthy. And then what it argues as well, when it is confronted with situations where these people that don't agree with them have become affiliated to universities, it simply tries to argue, well, they're not really universities. I mean, they're not proper universities. If they would do that, it will damage the reputation of the university if the university will be associated with such people. And when it finds cases of these people publishing in extremely high impact important scientific journals, rather than accept that they've probably got a point, their research has got through peer review with a very serious academic journal, so they probably this is reasonable, they turn around and say, oh no, well, that will damage the reputation of the journal, because the journal won't be considered as fully part of the guild. And when they find cases of people they don't like that do have university affiliations, the case is Michael Woodley here, they turn around and say, he doesn't have a university affiliation. So it was actually a case where Michael Woodley put down a university affiliation and he put UNS Review, which is this alt-right thing. And so they quoted the UNS Review thing and not the university affiliation in order to make him out as not being associated with the university, when in fact he was. So what you are dealing with is an attempt through manipulative means to put down science. But the best people, of course, are these amateurs. I mean, let me give you an example of one of them. There was somebody of these kinds of people. There was somebody called William Smith Ellis. Now, William Smith Ellis was born in 1817 in Hurst Pierpoint in Sussex, in West Sussex, and he became a barrister. But he never actually practiced as a barrister because of ill health. So he, from 1841, after qualifying as a barrister, he was basically looked after by his father, who was a landowner in Sussex. He then dedicated his time, all of his time, as far as we know, to his obsession with heraldry. With heraldry, and in particular a book in 1853 called A Plea for the Antiquity of Heraldry, in which he argued that heraldry didn't really merely begin in the 1200s, but went back a lot further, and that there were these people that were related to each other, different families that used the same sort of symbols in their coats of arms, and consequently this showed that heraldry had an earlier origin, because people that were related used the same kinds of images in their coats of arms, and so consequently it went back a lot further. He wrote a number of books on heraldry and made contributions to heraldry, with which he was obviously autistically obsessed, and he was also obsessed with local history. He wrote a history of Hurst Pierpoint, where he was from, and a history of the lords of the manors of this area and that sort of thing, and that's all he did. That was his life. Now, according to these kinds of people, as a qualified barrister, he should only have been writing about the law. That's all he had the right to talk about. But of course, in reality, he was a fascinating chap who was fascinated by all kinds of things, and in particular heraldry. And that's what you got with the Victorian amateur. There were so many of them, these Victorian amateur historians, Victorian amateur genealogists, Victorian amateur scientists. They were outside of the university system. They had independent fund. They had independent money. This guy, for example, he was a landowner. He had money from land. And so consequently, he could simply focus himself on whatever his fascination was. His fascination was heraldry. Now, you may find heraldry a rather obscure and recondite subject. I personally, I'm not particularly interested in it myself. But the point was that he was this autistic type with high intelligence who was utterly focused basically on one thing, heraldry, and to a lesser extent, local history. And that's what he did as an amateur person, and he made huge contributions. Now, he wasn't necessarily a genius, but it is that kind of person, that kind of psychology, without the strictures of the university, which is the person that makes major breakthrough contributions to things, such as Darwin. And so these people that try and argue, these professional anthropologists that try and argue that the open psych movement is somehow a problem, is somehow dodgy, all they are reflecting is the fact that they are midwits who are unable to come up with original ideas and who are unable to make genuine important contributions to science. And all they can do is just be part of a guild and gain social respectability through being part of a guild. But what they can't do is actual science that changes the world and that is important. And you are more able to do that in a lot of cases, not with the kind of science where you have to have access to machinery and whatever that's expensive, but certainly with things like history and things like data analysis, if you are outside the university. And I suspect as the universities become more and more politically correct and as employers become more and more sceptical of them because of the way in which they just churn out these left-wing conformists with left-wing conformist ideas, and therefore as the university degree is devalued, you will get a movement away from professionalized science and you will see the rise of the amateur. Because as we see in history, it is the amateur scientist who, A, has the kind of psychology which is associated with genuinely brilliant breakthroughs, B, is more able to come up with them because he's not working in the university environment, and C, is nonconformist, and that is the kind of thing that comes up with brilliant ideas, highly intelligent nonconformist. Such as William Smith Ellis, who I mentioned earlier, the heraldist, or Darwin, or whatever. So, I hope this has been of interest, and if it has, then please feel free to help support the show, which you can through Subscribestar and through Patreon, whatever, below. Remember that I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays, all at 7 p.m. UK time, and you might have to go to the channel to find it. And I will see you soon, and goodbye!